Hello, hello once again. My name is Jeff Watson. I am indeed your gracious and grateful host of the Inspired Minds podcast featuring the producer, Mr. Michael E. Simpson. What a gentleman he is. I am happy to be speaking to somebody on the air, at least probably just Michael, but that's okay. I have been having a lot of fun doing more interviews. I always say this, like more interviews and more interviews and more interviews. And I've also tried to, a couple of times I've asked people to make me a game show host, and that hasn't happened yet. I'm really kind of upset about that. I was actually on Rock and Roll Jeopardy on VH1. Fun fact, with young Jeff Probst, pre-Survivor, was the host of Rock and Roll Jeopardy, and I killed it. First round, it was okay. Second round, there was like double hands, boom, boom. I'm hitting weird ones, like I'm hitting like an old band called Killing Joke from the 80s, and I'm hitting an In Excess line, I'm hitting Dead or Alive. You spin me right round, like double, double, double. And then on the third and final one, I bet everything like a complete idiot. And not only, the question was just ridiculously hard. I at least stand by that. I got it wrong. First prize was all the money you could have won, which would have been $40,000. Second prize was a week in Hawaii. Third prize, ladies and gentlemen, was a His and Her DJ karaoke set, which you got to pay taxes on anyway, so I didn't win. Bottom line is, I have the credentials to be a game show host. That's where this entire rant is going. So, apropos of nothing, I had a fantastic conversation with this woman, Margaret Judson. Margaret Judson is a multivariant. A polymath. That's the term. She does a lot of stuff. Actress, fantastic stuff going on. Got some new stuff coming out we're talking about on this. And she's also a CNN journalist and a producer. So we got to these great conversations about ultimate truths and relative truths and Edward Murrow, for God's sakes, who both of us, of course, idolize because we're both news nerds and nerds in general. And it was fantastic. But the favorite part of the whole thing is that there were some technical difficulties during the recording, and I had to stop it. And then we were talking back and forth, and she says, okay, why don't you just cut back here and maybe I can listen to the last part. I'm like, yeah, we can kind of dial it in there and sew it up tight. And I said, you're producing my show right now, aren't you? And she's like, yeah, kind of, kid. So it was just a fantastic one. I would be remiss if I did not say to like, subscribe to the podcast. I forget to do this because I'm lazy, I guess, because I used to do this for a living for like 10 years as a digital marketer, and I've completely forgotten to do this now. Oh, well, as always, I hope that you enjoy the interview as much as I did making it. And we talked about working. No, we're not working, girl. We talked about broadcast news and network, and I got a chance to actually do my impression of network with Ned Beatty. It's good. I guess you'll see. Bye. Hello, everyone. Dazzle throng, as I always say. Hopefully dazzle. We'll see what happens. My name is Jeff Watson, and I have with me the absolutely divine Miss Margaret Judson. Say hello, divine Miss Margaret Judson.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Nice to talk to everyone.
I just pulled that from the divine Miss M, which would be Liza Minnelli, ladies and gentlemen.
Happy to be associated.
Well, there, she's divine, as are you. So the first thing that I always like to ask on these podcasts is the same standard question, which people probably are getting bored with. And that is, when you were younger, Margaret, what was the first thing that you can remember that inspired you when you were a kid? Was it a song or a book or a person? What lit you up?
Inspired me. What do you mean?
You tell me, was there a movie that you saw, like Wizard of Oz, where you were just captivated or something?
Interesting. Well, you know, actually, I have to say, this is kind of a crazy irony. I was not allowed to watch TV when I was little, for the most part. We technically had a TV in our house, but we weren't really allowed to watch it. And we didn't have cable, which was very weird for the time I grew up. And the irony of it is my entire career, for the most part, has been in cable television. But to that end, I was not allowed to watch TV, and we didn't have cable. And so I spent a lot of time outside, and I played a lot of sports. I was an athlete growing up. And, you know, actually something I've been thinking about lately that I have recently realized informs a lot of just the way I see the world and has probably all of my growing up is I was really inspired by my dad and grandfather. My grandpa was an orphan in Chicago. I'm from Illinois. And he was abandoned at the age of 3 and then went through, you know, the foster system and then made this whole life for himself. And I was always just so impressed by him. And I was really close with my dad in sort of the later part of our life. And anyway, there's this story that I've been thinking about recently that might answer your question. When I was little, like I said, I played a lot of sports, in kindergarten, it's all co-ed. And then by first grade, boys and girls split off in sports. And I remember at the very beginning of first grade, I went to Dryden Elementary School in Arlington Heights, Illinois. And I was on the playground one day. It was just, you know, we were out at recess or whatever. And I saw like a group of kids, which now I realize was this group of boys, sort of lined up by this really tall swing set. And there's really high pole and everybody was sort of taking a turn climbing it. And, hanging out it came to my turn to climb the pole. And as I went up to it, this kid, I'll never forget it. His name's John Volge, bless his heart. He screamed at me, "You can't do that. You're a girl."
What?
And I was like, I mean, I had no idea what that meant. Like at the time, like I said, it was all co-ed. Like I wasn't thinking about like, oh, boys are different than girls. Boys can do different things than girls. Like to me, everybody was on the same team.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, at that time, I just sort of like, I just remember the feeling of like, I don't even know what to do with that because like, he might as well have been yelling at me, "You can't do that because you have 2 ears. Like, I mean, like, oh, yeah, of course. Like, and anyway, so I went to go climb the pole and I couldn't do it. And I was like, okay, wait a minute. Maybe there's something to this thing that he said. It shook me. And I went home after school. And by the time my dad got home, I told him what had happened. And I don't remember the exact words, but the first thing I remember is what I would now classify. I don't think I had the words for it at the time, but what I would now classify is like rage. The first time I ever saw rage in somebody's eyes. And I... And I was like, okay, this adult is not happy with what I just said. And I said, you know, what does that mean? And I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember the exact words, but I do remember the feeling. And it was, the gist was, first of all, it means you go to school with a bunch of fucking idiots. And also it means, and more importantly, I think it means you have some work to do, which was a big message I got from my dad and especially my grandpa, who, like I said, was an orphan from 3 years old and just made his way in the world and became a very successful businessman completely on his own. And so and I grew up in the Midwest where it's like a very, you know, drilled into you. So it's like you have some work to do. So every day after dinner, we would go every single day. We would go back, walk back to school, and he would make me climb the pole every single day. And it would make me say something that I'm not going to say out loud because it's embarrassing. And it's also sort of just like my dad's not alive anymore. And it's something like very sacred that I remember about our relationship. And so he would make me repeat this sort of mantra as I was doing it. And I don't remember, like, I don't think there was any like sort of fuck you moment after that, but eventually I just needed to practice and do it. And looking back, I'm like, those kids were probably doing that all summer. You know, like I couldn't do it because I just hadn't done it before and I didn't have the practice. And so anyway, I think that inspires me or informs a lot of the way that I look at myself, look at the world, look at hard work, look at, you know, what I want to accomplish, the way I, you know, I'm a journalist, the way I pick stories, what I gravitate towards as an actor, the stories I gravitate towards. So that was just like it's just a story that I'm thinking about. You know, you're asking me on the spot. I'm not, I would say, you know, that is one moment that really like was a big part of my earliest memories and the way I moved through the world now.
So that's exactly why I asked these questions, because you gave me kind of a possible through line that can follow your path for the rest of your life. So the question now becomes, how did those things manifest to where you currently are? How do they push you along?
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. Actually, this project that we finished and is up for an Emmy now that I am so proud of, is exactly that, Jeff. You're exactly right. That early experience, like one of my earliest memories is sort of experiencing a glass ceiling, so to speak, or sort of realizing that that exists and questioning it and coming up against it. And that's a lens that informs the way that exactly like you're saying, it's the lens, I call it, you're calling it a through line. It's sort of the thing that carries me through. For example, I want to tell you about this project, Strut.
Yes.
It was such a fun project to work on. It's like this underdog story. And the core of it is about this group of women who are friends, who are up against the patriarchy. And it's like this sexy and fun female buddy comedy. It's created by Misha Calvert and directed by Michelle Cotolo. And practically the whole set was women. It was so fun to work on. And it felt groundbreaking. And now it's being put up for an Emmy. And I'm really honored and humbled that I'm being put up for an Emmy for Outstanding Actress in a Short Form Comedy or Drama Series is the category.
Wow.
So I'm so grateful. It aligns with my through line, in your words, or my soul or my core, my purpose. It's sort of, you know, like we've talked about, I know that a lot of this is about like a muse. That was like a primary inspiration. And for a long time it was subconscious. And through this project, especially, I've been able and very fortunate to, you know, realize that and play it out and act it out. It's very sex positive. It's like this very honest look at how women have to navigate a patriarchy as sexual beings in a capitalist society. There are like all of these layers, and it's sexy and fun and honest. And we're really proud of it. And we're so, so grateful that it's up for an Emmy. And I'm proud to be nominated as put up as an actor for it. So, you know, that has really carried me through even subconsciously in picking projects like Strut and being able to work with this group of women who are just like the hustlers of hustlers. It's been like such an honor and so fun. And I'm so proud of what we were able to do. And Misha's writing is just so delicious. And just, I keep using this word, but it is so honest. And that is something that just really resonates with me and is fun. It's just the truth. And it was so awesome to be a part of that. And yeah, like you're saying, it's that through line. And a lot of times I think for us, it can be a subconscious thing.
Correct.
You know, and I'm realizing that now, that, you know, that came from such an early memory. And, you know, I wrote a piece in the Times that had to do with intimacy coordinators. And, you know, I think that that is also part of it. That is all informed by these early messages that I got and was inspired by and just have to chase and be a part of. And, you know, just, oh, it's so delicious to me.
Delicious. What a great word. I love that. Absolutely. I talk about this sometimes on the show. There's this thing called radical amazement that I'm completely in love with this concept. And it just is simply that. It's you wake up in the morning, everything is amazing. Everything is incredible. You're one with the universe when you wake up in the middle or in the middle of the day, if you're Lynn Evangelista. But regardless, you wake up and you say, oh my God, everything is incredible, because I believe that to be spiritual is to be amazed. Truly amazed. And what's great about you also that you did say that I think is so fantastic. You said that the you're grateful that you are aligned with your through line. I thought that was absolutely brilliant, because it is that gratitude, it is that understanding of being an eternal student, to continue to be humble enough to learn, to continue to be humble enough to be grateful. You've got that in spades.
Yeah, I mean, this project was such a blessing, and it was so inspiring. And, you know, it, just like you said, it was a spiritual experience on some level, because it was part of my core being. And it was just like, you know, when you're in the, people call it flow, you know, a lot of times, you know, when you're aligned. And you know, you go in and out of it, but to be able to be part of this project, Strut was, I was aligned. It was a spiritual experience in a lot of ways.
So that gets me to, I guess the next question is, and I know that you went to University of Illinois. I lived in Schaumburg for a while. Great.
Oh, no way. Very close to Arlington Heights. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. There's two seasons they say in Chicago. Know.
Yeah.
Two seasons in Chicago, winter and construction.
Yeah.
Boom. Dumb joke. But so I saw that you began your broadcast career at the Page Program, right?
I did.
And Ryan Williams and all that. And then you became a research assistant at Keith Olbermann, which I assume kind of carried you through to sort of kind of where you are now. But back me up just for a heartbeat, because of course, the second anytime someone mentions Page, they think of the show 30 Rock. Is it, I mean, obviously it's not that, because the guy's an amazing comic and it was a great show, but tell me about that world. I'm always fascinated by it.
Oh my God. I loved being a page. Being a page was the best thing ever. Yeah. Actually, so I had an internship with Countdown with Keith Olbermann. It was the first time I had been to New York, even though at the time MSNBC was in Secaucus, New Jersey, but I lived for that summer in New York while I was doing my internship. And I mean, it's actually kind of a crazy story. When I, first got to the apartment that I was staying at, I was robbed. I had to be put in, I called the police. They came and swooped me up. They had to take me to a witness protection hotel in Queens, but not after we had to first stop at a shooting in Bed-Stuy before it was gentrified. And it is the Bed-Stuy it is today. I mean, it was just like such a crazy story. It probably says how crazy I am, but I was like, oh my God, I love this place. I need to go back. So that was the way I decided to go back, was as a page. It's a pretty grueling process to be accepted, but I was, which was just, I mean, I was beside myself. I was so happy about that. It is so fun to be a page. You're in, at that point, everybody had moved to 30 Rock. So everybody was in the same building. I had my MSNBC friends there that I had known from the summer before. And yeah, oh my God, I did everything. I worked the Super Bowl that year. I did the election. That's when Obama was became president. I did SNL. You do some tours in your downtime, but it is so awesome to be a page. I that was just such a cool entry into the world, and I was absolutely hooked.
I would imagine. I've actually been to 30 Rock for SNL. There was a band that I was working with that was on SNL, so I got to be in that not only the building but also that room. And everything, it's just buzzing.
In 8H,
yeah, small, so that you have to like squeeze past people, and everyone's moving around fast. And
yep,
amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
Isn't yeah, it? Yeah. You're just like. You know, at the time, that was when Jimmy Fallon had just started his show. I was actually on his third show. He was playing Serena Williams in beer pong, and a bunch of pages had to bring out pitchers of beer. And I was one of those pages. And it was just like such an exciting time in the building. And like you said, you're just like rubbing elbows with everybody. I mean, Conan would invite us to, you know, the page on the Conan desk would be like, okay, Conan's doing his monologue. You'd call up to the page, they'd call up to the page office, and we would all like go and sit in the back of the theater and watch him work out his monologue in real time for the show. I mean, it's just like, I mean, every cool thing. I remember my first after party, SNL after party, which turned into an after after, which turned into an after after
yeah,
after
I know.
Party. They have a 30 Rock joke about that. But it just goes on and on and on and on. And I remember, you know, I was up till, you know, whatever it was. I'm sure I didn't go to bed till, you know, 8 a.m. or something like that. And I remember calling my dad the next day by 4 p.m. when I probably woke up, and just like, I had the best night of my life.
Yeah.
It's like, what happened? It's like, I don't even know. It was just so awesome. I mean, I remember I met all the castmates. I had a dance off with Kristen Wiig. And Will Forte was a part of that. I mean, it was just like every like insane thing that you couldn't even imagine.
Sure.
It was so fun.
Was it at that bar? Let me just say this. I remember the first 2 hours of my after SNL party.
Yeah.
But then the other part that I do remember, weirdly enough, is I think it was at 4 o'clock, almost falling out of a cab that was turning a corner.
Yeah.
The only thing I remember after that.
And I was like, this is the best.
Yeah. Was it at that bar next door? Two story or like a high ceiling bar? I remember vaguely.
I don't remember. It might have been Zero Bond.
Whatever.
I mean, they were all over the place, and they had to keep switching the locations, and we would all be on like a text chain that was like, okay, now we're going here. Okay, don't tell me. It was like all very, very like under the radar. And we had to like try to be cool, which was very, I mean, impossible for me. There was no way I could be cool in those circumstances, but I just had so much fun.
I just forgot that I forgot that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just remember that I forgot. Anyway. So you were in this amazing page world. Then you went into Keith Olbermann. Now I want to start talking about this kind of branch here. I'm a major fan of good journalism. I'm also a major despiser of bad journalism. And I know and so with your background, you know, with Olbermann, and I do know that I really obviously want to get into the newsroom and specifically how you were working with Sorkin, and then the guy I got slipped into the acting world there. But the journalism thing is so fascinating to me. And there's one line that you had that I thought was brilliant in some interview that I read with your hometown. I might add your hometown college paper. I might say, congratulations.
Oh, what was it? I have no idea what you're going to say.
Local girl gone good kind of story.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. I'll send you your own press.
I don't know it.
It was right when the newsroom came out, and it was this local Girl Gone Good story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was actually in the University of Illinois paper. I'm doing way too
well. Oh, that's amazing.
Am I doing research for a researcher?
Yeah. Well, I definitely don't research myself. I stay away from this, as far away from that as possible.
Clearly. There we go. So here's the thing. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I want you to pull on this thread. I think journalism is a lot about understanding people and stories and how people act in stories and in circumstances and kind of analyzing that. So journalism is a form of storytelling in a more matter-of-fact way.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, there's a ton of overlap. You know, when I was deciding to leave real journalism to go pretend fake journalism on TV, somebody, a producer, said something to me that I'll never forget. He's one of my favorite producers on that show. He's so brilliant.
You can find great true fiction because we can tell truth in journalism in one medium.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. He's like, what was that they say about telling greater truths through fiction? Oh, yeah, that's what they say about it. I was like, oh, okay. Because I was very conflicted about it. I was like, why would I leave the real thing to go pretend it? And you just like opened my eyes to the fact that there's this whole other world to explore. But to your point, like, you know, it sort of illustrates that there is a ton of overlap. You know, Edward R. Murrow said, we're all editorializing. And I think about that all the time because it speaks to storytelling in general. Everybody has a lens. And it's something that I really try to share with as many news consumers, which I think is pretty much all of us in one way or another, as possible. Because yeah, you're talking about good journalism, bad journalism. I mean, we know what I know what you mean. And also, I think it's so
important. Laura Ingraham, go ahead.
God bless you. I think that you know, it's so important to remember that there is a group of human beings deciding. What, and I know people want to boil it down to ratings or not, but it's so much more than that and way more nuanced than that. And what I think about it more as is stories that people, human beings, journalists who are human beings are attracted to and know other people will be attracted to as well and want to dig into and learn from and explore and, you know, and all of that. So I think it's sort of a nuanced thing in that way.
It is. And I believe that the shortest distance between two people is a story.
Yeah, you absolutely. Know? Yeah, because, the empathy factor of it.
And I say this all the time these days. I've been saying that we're in a pandemic of disconnection in this nation like never before, right? And it's that connection. Sure. It's that connection that we need, which is through storytelling. That's why people go to fucking movies, Republicans or Democrats. Or,
yeah,
right. I mean, that's what connects us all. It is connected.
And when you say Republicans or Democrats, what I hear is community.
Correct.
I think, correct. You know, when, and, you know, we've talked a little bit about our past when, you know, I think what a lot of pain boils down to is lack of community and lack of connection, like you're saying. And, you know, finding your place, finding who you connect with, all that, you know, that's what I hear when you're talking about, you know, sides of the aisle.
1,000%. And it is just horrifying. Mm-hmm. In fact, can I go dark for a second? And then I want your opinion on this. And then maybe you can lighten it up with some talks about, I don't know, my little fucking point or something. But here we go. So pardon me. I believe that we have never been this more divided in human history. Or at least let's say America. But get this. I was thinking about this and want your opinion on this. So have you heard people say that we have not been more divided since the Civil War?
I feel like I've heard that. Sure.
That is untrue mathematically, because you're going to appreciate this as a journalist, because I started thinking to myself, how the hell did a farmer in Iowa know about the Civil War? Okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe if he's lucky, he found out about it from newspapers a week or 2 weeks late anyway, because it's on fucking horseback. right?
Right.
So it's like, hey, the Battle of Antietam just started. Yes, it's actually over. Sorry. So,
yeah.
So that's how he found out, if he did. So I did the research and I thought, I wonder how many circulation total there was back in the Civil War, 1865. And there was 450,000, right? And that's New York, that's Atlanta, you know, Texas, kind of that thing. And then I thought, okay, got, I think it was maybe 500,000 people in the war. I don't remember, to be honest with you, but let's just say rough numbers. That's a mill. Let's say that maybe half of those people told their friends, and so now you got 1.5 million who are aware of the war and of what's going on in this nation. You got 333 fucking million people with Twitter, social media.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely.
And that's what scares me to death. To death. Because we talk about division of thought, you know. And here's the problem I've noticed too. And again, I do want your thoughts on this before I'm done rambling, is that because as a psychologist guy now, or therapist, I understand that truth is a lot harder to process than fear, right? Because fear is in the amygdala, in the middle brain, and that's just really, you know, that's heavy emotion. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Run, fight, freeze, get angry. Truth is in the prefrontal cortex, which takes a little bit of time to get to, by the way. It's not immediate. And that takes time to coalesce and bring together and be rational about truth. That's harder to do. So Fox goes, spreads like wildfire, because it is wildfire. And these things, these attempts at larger concepts and actually rational thinking get diminished.
I mean, my first reaction, just to opining on just I think it's hard to compare truth and fear. Fear is a visceral reaction to an individual, and truth is, depending on whatever it is tends to be a nuanced, you know, multifaceted understanding of a particular concept. So I think, yeah, that's hard to draw necessarily like a direct comparison. And you know what? I mean, to be fair, news as a business, and my former boss, Aaron Sorkin, wrote a play about when news became a business called The Farnsworth Invention. And so I don't begin to defend news as a business, but I think that something I wish that there was more of an ability to do was to like dig into nuance. But no matter what network you're talking about or publication or whatever it is.
It's true. And also don't forget there are differences between truths. There's your relatives and your.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's your relatives and your universal.
Right. Yeah.
Like there is no square circle. That is a universal truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, right. And that's.
that.
Right. And that's a simple thing. There are some simple things, but yeah, no, I think it's a complicated thing. And I
it is.
Like it is. To be open to nuance, like I said.
And you could also argue that truth is relative anyway, to a certain uh-huh. degree. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Rashomon, the Japanese film with Kurosawa. Mm-hmm. And they talk mm-hmm. about that. In the film, there's a woman who is raped and murdered in the middle of a field. And there are four people at the other ends of the field watching what happened. And they each have different truths about what happened, depending on the angle.
Mm.
It's a perfect distillation, yeah. An example of what relative yeah. looks like. But
I want to see that.
Truth's boring.
Exactly my point.
Exactly.
gets us into this whole mess.
I do have to ask this, as I think this is fantastic, is that when, so again, you mentioned Aaron Sorkin, and I'm a big Aaron Sorkin fan. My God, that guy can write, obviously. And so he was working on the draft. You were his consultant because he was going back and forth with you, it sounds like, and you were on email. And finally, someone was just like, pay me. And and he gave you the script for the first draft, and it was you. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So yeah, what happened was I was working for Keith Olbermann, and coincidentally, Aaron had worked with Olbermann before on a show called Sports Night. And when he wanted to do this show, do you know that show?
Love that show.
So when he wanted to do a show about news, Keith had transitioned that way. And so he came and followed our team. And I mean, there wasn't much to it. You know, he came and shadowed everybody, and I was kind of in charge of him that day. And that was kind of it. And eventually he was going to do press for in the building. And like we were talking about rubbing shoulders with everybody. He was in the building doing press for Social Network, and he was doing a late night show. It was Fallon, I think. And I ran into him in the elevator bank, and I said, you know, Mr. Sorkin, I don't know if you remember me, but blah, blah, blah. I explained it. And he was like, oh yeah, I remember you, and I actually have a draft. And so he sent me the draft and then had a bunch of questions about it. And that's how it sort of turned into me being a consultant. And there was one particular character who I was very connected to. The name was very similar, among many other things. And so, you know, in sort of a fit of confidence, I decided to reach out to ask if I could audition for it. By the way, like I said, I didn't watch TV. I was an athlete. I didn't do plays in school. Like, this was like way out of the blue, but it was so familiar. The character was so familiar. I just would have kicked myself if I didn't ask. So I did, and he actually turned me down. He said, you know, this is for very serious actors. These are people who are coming out of, you know, Juilliard, and, you know, have committed their entire lives to this. This isn't, you know, little one-off thing, which I completely understand and respect and was very transparent about and fair. Next thing I know, I get a call from Francine Maisler, which I did not know at the time, but is one of the biggest casting directors in town. And she asked me, so I, the last thing I'd heard from Aaron is no. And then all of a sudden I'm getting a call from this casting director who asked me if I would come and audition. And I went at the, you know, we were at 30 Rock, which is like on 49th, HBO and 49th and like 6th. And HBO is at like 34th and 6th. And so I walked a few blocks down to HBO and did my audition for Francine. All of the director, Greg Mottola, was there, all of the HBO execs and the EPs. And long story short, that audition went very well. And next thing I knew, I was moving to Los Angeles to do a pilot for the show, which thank God I didn't realize how often pilots do not get picked up, because I left my job at MSNBC and I left New York and I moved to LA to do this thing, which, you know, ended up being a years long thing, thank God. But there was a lot of naivete around it. And thank God, because if I had known how what a steep cliff I was jumping off of, I wouldn't have done it. But it just, you know, sort of went for it and it worked out.
But it was Aaron Sorkin. It wasn't that much of a, I mean.
And again, you know, I wasn't doing all the calculations, but yes, when Aaron Sorkin is doing a pilot for HBO and they're, you know, now I know they were very behind it and all of that. So yes, it got picked up. Maybe
in hindsight, you got lucky.
But now I look at it, you know, big picture, and I'm like, whoa, that was a gamble on the face of it.
Yes, it certainly was. If you just for a small heartbeat, if you don't mind, I'm going to go back and I just remembered this, and I don't want it to escape my crazy, weird brain. Speaking of 30 Rock, just for a second, So this band that I used to work with over at the record company I worked at, the band was called, is actually called My Chemical Romance. The nicest human.
Oh, God, yeah.
Sweetest guys in the world. Oh, my God. Just the greatest band I've ever worked with in my life. Just best friends and all that. But they did a show at the top of the 30 Rock. It was for the MTV Video Awards. And it was on, you know, it's top of the building. And they were playing live. And it was this big thing. It is freezing. And it's windy. And I don't like heights. And I am kind of freaking out. It was a wild evening.
That sounds so fun. That was probably when the Rainbow Room was still there. That sounds like so fun. Oh God.
I love
it. Oh, that's what a dream.
That building was great. Cause you know, SNL was there obviously.
Yeah, like yeah. You
said, and the offices mm-hmm. were there too. The New York offices. So it was kind of a one-stop shop.
Yeah. Very cool. It never got old walking in those doors. It's always just like thrilling.
I had the similar experience actually working at Warner Brothers Records because I was in the LA office, and the LA office, it's not there anymore, unfortunately, but for about 50 years, it was designed like an old Redwood ski chalet back, like a real 70s kind of wood thing going on. And it was amazing.
Oh, cool.
It was like history. I went down to the basement and I found all these artifacts, like the Led Zeppelin recording budget line items with had like, seriously, it was like $50,000 for a car. It's not a car, it's for cocaine. Like, come on, you're burying. I know what this is. Not about me, it's about you. So here's the next thing I got for you. So now that you, okay, so you became an actress, like, so there, you have that acting in you. How hard was that to transition into? What was that like?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I was flying by the seat of my pants. I really wish that I could go back and do it knowing what I know now more than anything. I mean, you could say that. I mean, I could probably say that about anything. But that, out of everything, I wish I could go back knowing what I know now. But, you know, it didn't happen now. It happened then. And, you know, I learned on the job, and I've met amazing people. I mean, it's just like you're surrounded by the best in the business and made really great friends. And, you know, it was a steep learning curve. And I got to be in the writer's room as a consultant for a bunch of the episodes, especially in the beginning. And, you know, I learned so much from just hearing Aaron talk about story, you know, so it was incredible. And yeah, it was a steep learning curve, but it was really thrilling and exciting. And, God, yeah, it was great.
Okay. Let's go deeper here. Do you think that there are threads of your current journalism work that have been kind of pulled from your acting world subconsciously, maybe, or not?
What do you mean?
I mean that when you are an actress, actor, that you have there's a process, let's say. You know, everyone's got their method, you know, it's method or it's Meisner or any kind of techniques. And those are things that you kind of look inside yourself when you create characters. Obviously, you could do backstories and the whole thing, right? It's a different discipline, I would imagine, at least pretty much, than journalism. But now that you have that in you, obviously you've done the acting thing. You know what that is. Did that experience as an actor change you and then maybe kind of colored your journalism work a little bit? Or maybe I'm going way too far with this.
Yeah, no, I think that, like you're saying, all of our experiences sort of inform the next thing, and we get to just build on. And I've been back and forth a lot. Like, one of my favorite times in my career was when I was producing the morning show on CNN. This is when I was still in New York. I was producing the morning show and I was on CNN, and I was doing The Deuce, which was on HBO, the David Simon show, during the day. And so we would shoot that, and then I would, you know, produce at night. Wow. And, you know, they are different, but this is a little bit of a different than the question you asked, but they inform each other. Like, I mean, that, like you said, like, that is in me. I will always, like, my lens will forever be shifted because of that. And, you know, I think it's helped me hone my my view or lens as a storyteller. I don't know if it impact. I don't know if I would say it impacts my day-to-day journalism, you know, duties, but it definitely has shifted the way that I see the world. And I think that has a lot to do with it. Yeah.
That makes,
I would say it like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because it's that persona that we all kind of,
yeah,
we suck in all of our different experiences, become the totality of who we are. And that continues to grow that way. Now,
right.
Here's the other, I'm trying to think where I want to go with this one. Okay. As a journalist, or no, I take it back. As a storyteller, here's the question. As a storyteller, mm-hmm. I often yeah. say this as well, and I want you to agree or disagree, Margaret. You ready? Here we go.
I'm ready.
Agree to disagree, or agree or disagree. That is, that is, in order to be a good storyteller, you have to be able to do two things. One, you got to tell the story. Doesn't matter what that even means. Can be books, can be television, can be poetry. You got to tell it well and connect. But the harder thing is to find it. To find the story. Thoughts?
The harder thing is to find the story. Well, it's interesting. In my journalism life, we find the story every day. Like we're mining stories every day. So that's actually harder. I don't know if I'd say it's harder, but it's, like, I mean, yeah, I kind of think of it as manual labor. Like I imagine like a miner, like going after whatever it is, and looking and pitching, you know, what we could maybe be talking about. I think it's harder to tell the story. I think it's harder to tell the story.
May I challenge your metaphor on the miner?
Yeah, yeah.
So a miner knows what he's looking for, or she. A miner knows what him, they like to are looking for. And
I think they're chipping away. They're chipping away, and they're looking for something. Maybe they know the material that they're looking for, but they don't know what necessarily it's going to look like or how much, or you know, that could go a million ways.
I see what you're saying. I do. And you're right. I mean, perhaps it's fair to say it's equal. I guess my whole point is finding the story. I try and, because I said I'm a therapist and I try to get my clients to be what I'm calling story aware, just to be aware of stories around you, because you have to do that as a journalist. You have to. And you get honed. You get honed to it. You know, you're like, oh, I know that's a story because that's got a beginning and a middle and an end and I can see it. Most people can't do that. And I want to educate people to become that, to become an investigative journalist of their life and find the stories, the stories of their own lives.
Yeah, I think, you know, yeah, something so important in the work that I do with my colleagues right now is, you know, just to really focus on editorial judgment and deciding, you know, we have this like mountain of stuff or cave of stuff, if we're following the metaphor.
Yes.
And
good work.
And, you know, we're chipping away like this for this reason. What about this? Is this a problem? Does this disqualify it? Does it fit with, the rest of, you know, that hour that we're doing, where does it fit in? Do we save it till tomorrow? You know, there's just kind of like a lot of stuff like that. And like Edward R. Murrow said, we're all editorializing. So it really comes down to, as a human being, what in your gut do you feel is a story and why, and what does it mean?
The great Edward Murrow, man, if you're around today, good God, but that leads me to another thing I did want to mention to you. Have you seen the amazing documentary that was done about the William Buckley Gore Vidal debates back in the 60s?
When? I'm thinking Frost Nixon. No, I haven't.
No, you got to watch this as a journalist, especially. You're going to love this. There's a great documentary that was done. The story is that back in the 60s, around the Chicago 68 Democratic Convention, this is an amazing story. ABC was broke. NBC, CBS was killing them in the ratings. So they had this weird idea, and they said, you know what? We're going to get two guys up on stage. We're going to do every week during the entire convention. It's either every night or every week during the convention, like 8 debates between Gore Vidal, who was a staunch liberal, very gay.
Yeah, sure, Bradley, right?
And they got up on stage, and they debated. And that was it. And it was big government, small government. And they took shots at each other because that's what they were doing. And it was good TV and actually did great in the ratings. Everyone was surprised because back then people weren't so amygdala triggered. They weren't so, you know, trans, or they weren't so Disney, right? And you could have kind of a rational discussion with these two guys who were absolutely brilliant and taking shots at each other. And it was huge ratings, massive.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's a lost
art. Oh, I'd love that.
That discourse is an incredibly lost art. And so much of it has to do with social media, because if you've got a tiny little bit of character space, what are you going to do? You're going to put a big headline that said Fauci is a devil. That's easy. Right? You're not going to talk about the completely difficult and labyrinthian concepts of immigration. No, it's wall, brown guy, bad.
Right, yeah.
Visa overstays. These assholes don't talk about visa overstays at all. Why? Because they're European.
Right? I'm avoiding saying anything political. But
oh, well, I'm not. Okay. I'll speak for perhaps both of us. If not, you can say quiet. I understand why you're not. I will, however. Fuck these guys. But look, my whole point is, and perhaps this is a somewhat good note to kind of slowly wrap this up with, please tell me, and if you have not seen this movie, you absolutely must. Have you ever seen the 1974 movie called Network?
Of course.
Boom.
Obsessed.
Boom.
I'm obsessed with it. And I think, well, I'm very interested in the way net neutrality is sort of like the new network.
Say that again. Tell me more about that. You sound smart.
Now, net neutrality is basically like, you know, especially with how these enormous media conglomerates just keep eating the little guy, and just getting bigger and bigger and turning into some version of an opoly as we go on and on. The net neutrality is the decision of what will make it through the tubes, if you will, for the internet. This was Al Franken's cause. We're getting, especially after the past administration, we're getting further and further away from it. But I think it's like a very sacred thing. And how I mentioned the Farnsworth invention, it's like we're in that place where we're right, like, at this turning point of when something is pure versus when something is a business. And anyway, I think about Network all the time, or how it applies to net neutrality. I wish there was a way to adapt it.
It is the most precious.
I think there's a modern day version of it, and it hinges on net neutrality.
I do not disagree. I will say this, that Pat Chayefsky script was the most profound, like Isaiah, the prophet, wasn't that on point. Mm-hmm. Jesus. Mm-hmm. Like, talk about prophecy, right? And talk about
especially with like the prophet imagery in it. Brilliant.
The so mad brilliant. Prophet, Howard Beale.
Yeah.
Right. And the mm-hmm. fact that they're even, yeah. That movie was so amazing. The fact that they had, by the way, this is the second conversation about Network that I've had on a show so far. I love it.
But oh,
that,
really?
Yeah. Because there's that great scene, terrifying scene where Faye Dunaway and Robert Duvall, and they're talking about the execution of Howard Beale like it's a business decision, which it is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How are the ratings going to be if we kill off Howard Beale? Well, we'll get an upshare probably. Great. Done. Next. Like that. Right. Movie, and my God, that scene with the mighty, mighty. God, now I'm drawing a guy's. What was the guy's name? I'm drawing a blank on this now. He was in Deliverance. Oh, my God. Anyway, that whole movie is fantastic. I'm glad that you like it, because people who were in that business tend to know it.
Yeah. It's one of the most important movies about journalism in that way, or media.
Oh, I know what it is.
There is, yeah.
Ned Beatty in that big room where he's like, "You have meddled with the forces of nature, and you shall atone." Mr. Beale? Anyway.
So good.
Oh, yeah. Best. So I want to wrap this up a little bit here, but I do want to ask you kind of a final question. It's the only other question that I basically have for these, for any of the shows. And that is simply, when you are, let's say you're sewing up a show, right? You got a segment that you're doing. When do you know you're done? When do you know you can hand it off to somebody?
At 9:30. I work on a morning show and it's basically a 24-hour operation. And so I do the bulk of the, I do the producing of it. And then it comes a time. I mean, it's live television. So there is a time that is a deadline and we pass it off to the control room and that's it.
Yeah, I got to say, by the way, honestly, thank you for that answer. They're always great because they're always different. But I would be remiss if I did not discuss Broadcast News for a Heartbeat, the movie.
Oh, yeah. I haven't. I saw that. I've only seen that once. It was a long time ago.
Got to watch it again. Great scene.
Yeah.
Great scene with Joan Cusack where they throw a tape. Like by the way, my hero is Albert Brooks for life, AB, my man. Yeah. When she grabs the tape from Albert Brooks or other producer and they're like running. She slides underneath a door, like underneath a drawer, like slides, hands down.
I know the scene. Yes. I do know the scene that you're talking about. Yes. That's exactly it. Like, I mean, Hunter, it's finite.
And Holly Hunter as the very neurotic producer.
She's amazing.
Incredible.
I love her in Raising Arizona.
First date I ever had, by the way. Fun fact.
You're joking.
Girl to go see that movie. Angie Freeman, if you're listening out there, you broke my heart, but we had a good time. Huh? I'm serious.
Oh, I thought you meant with Holly Hunter.
Oh, good Lord, no.
I was like, I am jealous.
Wish that was the case. Angie Freeman. Nope. Lady from my heart.
I'm sure Angie's great too.
No, I guess not. No, she's terrible. Yeah. 30 years ago, I'm so depressed.
Oh, Angie.
Listen, you have been an absolute delight, like they say. So here's how I wrap these things up. We're going to take a little moment to say goodbye, kind of officially, and then we're going to hang up, or I'm going to stop recording, and then we're going to unofficially say goodbye without anybody listening, so you can say whatever the hell you want. Deal?
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
So, Margaret Judson, thank you so much. My God, any fan of the network is a friend of mine. Thank you for doing the show. You say goodbye.
Thanks so much for having me. I've had such a great time. Bye, everybody.
Say goodbye to the dazzled audience.
Goodbye, dazzled audience. I hope you had as great a time as I did.
Oh, you're a delight. Hang on. I'm going to quote unquote hang up. Click.